Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Florida has ordered a mandatory recount of both its Senate and gubernatorial results from last week's election, and hopefully, if all goes well with the Florida recount, by next week, Al Gore will be president.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to actor and director Paul Dano, who also continues the conversation backstage at Studio 8G just for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
President Trump is becoming more lawless amid a power grab at the Justice Department and a recount in Florida. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Trump has always seen the law not as a constraint on his power, but as a tool to protect and enrich himself. Today, for example, he attacked Democrats for saying they'll investigate him now that they control the House, tweeting the prospect of presidential harassment by the Dems is causing the stock market big headaches. And last week, he said that if Democrats in the House use their power to investigate him, he'll just turn around and investigate them.
Are you offering an my way or highway scenario to the Democrats? You're saying that if they start investigating you, that you can play that game and investigate
better
them.
Better than them.
Can you compartmentalize that?
And I think I know more than they know.
No. No, you don't. Trump's like a Gotham City gangster who thinks he can outsmart Batman and ends up dangling from a gargoyle. Bad news, Batman. I also have a utility belt. Oh, son of a bitch! Oh, I'm upside down again. Oh, that backfired. Grifters always think they can outsmart everyone else, and that's what Trump is, a grifter who surrounds himself with other grifters. Right now, as we speak, Trump is being sued in federal court for defrauding investors. He just appointed an acting attorney general who advised a firm accused of scamming customers, and his candidate for Senate in Florida, the state's governor, was involved in one of the largest Medicare frauds in American history.
President Trump, three of his adult children, and their company are now facing a new lawsuit over allegedly conning consumers in a, quote, systematic fraud and pattern of racketeering.
Matt Whitaker, the now acting attorney general after Jeff Sessions was fired, he is now linked to a company referred to as a scam.
Rick Scott earned his fortune in healthcare administration. He served as the CEO of the Columbia Hospital Corporation. Scott resigned in 1997 amid a fraud scandal encompassing Medicare, Medicaid, and other federal programs.
Man, if these guys weren't in politics, they'd be selling fake Rolexes on the sidewalk in Times Square.
Of course it's a real Rolex. The extra X is for extreme.
Trump's entire career has been built on scamming people. In fact, even in the closing weeks of the presidential campaign, Trump was personally involved in a scheme to break campaign finance law by paying hush money to hide his alleged affairs, as we learned on Friday.
The Wall Street Journal reporting federal prosecutors have evidence that Donald Trump played a central role in paying off women during the 2016 campaign who claimed they had affairs with him.
The Wall Street Journal reporting that during the 2016 campaign, Donald Trump closely coordinated with American Media Inc. chairman David Pecker to silence two women who claimed they had affairs with Trump.
You know, there's a lot that's hard to believe about the Trump era, but one thing I will never get over is the fact that the president asked a friend to help him cover up an affair with a Playboy model, and that friend's last name was literally pecker. It's like the worst screenplay in a freshman creative writing class. I need a name for the guy who covers up the sex stuff. Oh, I know. I'll call him Rex Penis. So prosecutors now have evidence that Trump personally violated election law during a presidential campaign, which makes it pretty convenient that he just installed an acting attorney general, Matt Whitaker, who is very much a Trump loyalist. And much like Trump, Whitaker also has a history with fraud.
Whitaker later joined the advisory board and was first paid in October 2014 for a company that has since been shut down and slapped with a $26 million fine by federal authorities. World Patent Marketing billed itself as helping investors secure patents, and Whitaker was hands-on.
It's a unique design that's going to help.
Showcasing a hot tub invention in this post from the company.
That's right. The new Attorney General of the United States was involved in a scam selling hot tubs. Not only does this administration keep adding grifters, the scams keep getting worse. Our next Secretary of State's going to be a guy who forges signatures on baseballs. How did Trump pick this guy? Well, Whitaker basically auditioned for the role by going on TV and criticizing the Russia investigation. In fact, at one point, Whitaker, who now oversees the Russia investigation, said the infamous meeting Donald Trump Jr. had with the Russians at Trump Tower in 2016, totally fine.
If you have somebody that you trust that is saying you need to meet with this individual because they have information about your opponent, you would take that meeting. You certainly want to have any advantage, any legal advantage you can, and one of those main advantages is to know what your opponent is either, you know, I mean, all sorts of things that could be happening. Hillary Clinton, there was so much smoke around her.
There was smoke around her. Trump has so much smoke around him, he looks like he's been hanging out on Willie Nelson's tour bus. So on Friday, reporters asked Trump if he had picked Whitaker because he saw him on TV attacking the Russia investigation, and Trump made it sound like he'd never even met the guy.
Well, Matt Whitaker, I don't know Matt Whitaker.
So there you go. Trump says there's no conflict of interest because he doesn't know Matt Whitaker. And if Trump says something, then you know. He also said the exact opposite.
In the Washington Post this morning, it says that you talked to the Attorney General's chief of staff about replacing the Attorney General. Apparently, according to the Post, you talked to Matthew Whitaker. Anything to that story?
Well, I never talk about that, but I can tell you Matt Whitaker is a great guy. I mean, I know Matt Whitaker.
Of course he knows him. If anyone looks like they should be friends with Trump, it's poor man's Telly Savalas over here. And on top of everything else, Whitaker's appointment itself might be illegal. Whitaker wasn't next in line at the Justice Department, and he's never been confirmed by the Senate. Last week, two prominent lawyers wrote an op-ed arguing that Whitaker's appointment was unconstitutional. And one of those lawyers has a personal connection to the White House.
Kellyanne Conway's own husband, George Conway, a self-described conservative, co-authored an op-ed in the New York Times, calling Whitaker's appointment as acting AG unconstitutional, illegal, and invalid.
That's right. One of the authors of the op-ed was George Conway, the husband of White House counselor Kellyanne Conway. And this isn't even the first time he's criticized Trump in public. What's that marriage like? Honey, could you pass the chicken? There is no chicken. I'm looking right at the chicken. That's not chicken. That's alternative meatloaf. Trump was asked. Trump was asked on Friday about George Conway's criticism, and he decided to attack the husband of one of his closest advisors.
Is Kellyanne's husband wrong?
Who?
Kellyanne's husband wrote that this.
You mean Mr. Kellyanne Conway? Why don't you ask Kellyanne that question, all right? All right? She might know him better than me. I really don't know the guy.
Okay, so he definitely knows the guy. But Trump, of course, is no expert in marriage. In fact, after that talk with reporters, Trump started to walk away to get on his helicopter and forgot that he left his wife standing by herself off camera.
I'll see you in Europe. See you. No, that's the polite way to do it. You take a big bendy arc,
In olden times, that was considered chivalrous. Goodbye, everybody. Goodbye.
I mean, at least he went back for her. Melania won, Umbrella zero. It's obvious that Trump wants Whitaker to rein in the Russia probe and the special counsel Robert Mueller, but when he was asked about Mueller on Friday, Trump claimed he wasn't even thinking about it.
I haven't ruled out anything. I haven't even thought about it. I'm thinking about the world.
The world? Globalist. You should be thinking about America first. Of course there is. There is one other thing on Trump's mind, and that's the recount in Florida, where the GOP candidates for governor and Senate, Ron DeSantis and Rick Scott, are narrowly leading. After Election Day, officials were still counting mail ballots and provisional ballots, which is totally normal and happens in every election. But Trump and Scott have been lying and spreading baseless conspiracy theories about non-existent voter fraud.
Every Floridian should be concerned there may be rampant fraud happening in Palm Beach and Broward counties.
Any evidence of
fraud? Well, you take a look at the past. Take a look at the
right
past.
Now,
and all of a sudden, they're finding votes? You mean after the election, they're finding votes?
Yeah. That's when you find votes, after people cast them.
I planted seeds in my garden, and 2 weeks later, I'm finding flowers. Fraud.
And then today, Trump tweeted that the vote counting should just stop because his candidates are ahead.
The Florida election should be called in favor of Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis, and that large numbers of new ballots showed up out of nowhere, and many ballots are missing or forged. An honest vote count is no longer possible. Ballots massively infected must go with election night.
Hey, man, you don't get to just stop counting the votes because you're ahead. Trump's like a guy who starts a game of horse, scores one basket, and says, actually, we were playing, so I win. I win. I'm the winner. Trump was then asked if he had any evidence that there was fraud happening in Florida, and since there is no evidence, he had no answer.
You notice the votes never go the other way? They hire lawyers, and the votes don't ever seem to go the Republican way. Although I hear, well, I don't know, you tell me.
All right, we'll tell you no. You don't have evidence of fraud in Florida. In fact, I'd be shocked if you even knew which state Florida was. If you asked him to describe it, he'd probably say it's the one that's shaped like a...
pecker.
So... Trump doesn't have any evidence of voter fraud, but don't worry, he's putting his best people on it.
As soon as Democrats sent their best election-stealing lawyer, Mark Elias, to Broward County, they miraculously started finding Democrat votes. Don't worry, Florida, I am sending much better lawyers to expose the fraud.
Oh, you're gonna send your lawyers to look at ballots? Like this guy? I'm not sure he's your best bet. I mean, look at him. He looks like he just got kicked in the...
pecker.
So, we have to get our pecker jokes in now while we can. The guys lying about non-existent voter fraud are the ones who have committed actual fraud. A grifter president put a grifter in charge of the Justice Department and is trying to get another grifter elected to the Senate. But like the grifter he is, Trump always abandons the people who serve him. Whether it's Attorney General, his personal fixer, or even someone as close to him, like his own...
pecker.
This has been a closer look.
Our guest is a Golden Globe-nominated actor you know from films like Love and Mercy and Little Miss Sunshine. He's starring in the upcoming Showtime series Escape at Dannemora later this month. He co-wrote his directorial debut, Wildlife, which is in select theaters nationwide now. Please welcome to the show, Paul Dano, everyone. How are you?
I am great.
Congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
I know it's your directorial debut, also your writing debut. You co-wrote it with your wife, Zoe Kazan.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always fascinated by the process of people who collaborate on writing. As a married couple, how did you figure out? Were you sitting in a room together at the same time working on it?
No. So I think most people imagine, right, somebody standing and pacing behind the computer, and
yes,
the other person's typing away, and you're just having an... simply would not work when we live together and go to bed together and wake up together. And we actually discovered a supernatural workflow, which I hope we get to do again someday, which is We simply traded drafts back and forth. So I would take it away for a while. We'd go over it. We'd be each other's editor in a way, and she would take it. And it was really actually fun.
Did you ever have to watch the other person read the draft? Because that would be very stressful.
Yeah, but I learned my lesson the first draft I wrote. I waited for her to read it. It was an eternity. And she had a lot of notes.
So, Carey Mulligan, who's one of the stars, is fantastic in it. You said it to her. She did not wait a long time to read it.
No, probably the fastest read I'll ever have. I mean, and luckily, I know Carey, so I could call her. I said, hey, I'm going to send you the script tonight. And the next morning, she called, and she was all in from the get-go. And she's a really great actor. So to have somebody like that respond that immediately to the character, to the script, was just a great burst of energy and was such an important step in the process.
Yeah, because nothing's worse than when you give somebody something to read. If each day that passes, you just in your head think that they're coming up with a way to phrase how little they liked it.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, also, being friends, you know, when we have to let somebody down, it's the worst. So you know she'd be pacing around her room, oh, my God, I got to call Paul and let go of this somehow. And so, yeah, luckily.
You shot in Oklahoma and Montana. It's a beautiful film. I know you and Zoe went out to the Northwest. Did you drive out there?
So we did. The family in the film moves from Lewiston, Idaho, to Great Falls, Montana. So we thought, let's go do the road trip that the family does. Beautiful part of the country. So we took like a little vacay writing trip, stayed in bed and breakfast. So Zoe wanted to go on a hike one day out to this waterfall we heard about.
Are you hiking people?
No.
Okay.
We live in Manhattan.
You live in Manhattan. Yeah, it's not.
We're city dwellers.
Yes. Okay. Gotcha.
And it's like bear season, apparently. It's like end of August, early September.
Yeah, that would be something I wouldn't know. I would have to be told.
No,
yeah.
we were told this. Okay, but the bears are apparently like storing up for the winter. So they're hungry. They know what's coming. So I asked the woman at the bed and breakfast, hey, we're going to go for this hike. You know, the bears. And she happened to be a woman who worked at the San Diego Zoo for like 30 years. She said, well, you don't want to run into a bear because they pin you down and peel you like a banana. Uh-huh. She was like, if you're going to run into something, you know, a lion is better because they go straight for your throat. I was like, thanks.
Yeah, this seems wildly unhelpful. Yeah.
So I said to Zoe, I was like, let's go to like the mountaineering store, the trail store. I don't even know what to call the store one goes to like buy, you know,
right.
Hiking
Both of those
apparel.
Sounded pretty good, yeah.
And I said, let's go talk to them. And I said, hey, the bears, you know, do I worry about this? They said, no, you know, like, don't shower. I mean, don't shampoo, condition, don't wear deodorant, you know. And if you're on your womanly times, you know, they can smell that. And I looked at Zoe, and that morning she had taken a bath, shampoo, conditioner, deodorant. She had put sunscreen on every inch of her body. And she was on her period.
There you go. That's the hat trick for bears right there.
You know, it was like a cartoon when my wife turned into this little edible bear treat, you know. And they said, just make a lot of noise as you walk. So we started on our hike, and so she's having a great time bopping around the trails. And I'm just seeing her like this animated bear treat. And so every 5 to 10 seconds, I was just shouting, yo, bear! Just kind of letting them know I was here.
That sounds like the least relaxing hike that's ever been taken.
I'm so embarrassed to say that I was terrified the whole time.
Yeah, no, I think that is very accurate, and I think you behaved the right way. And you both made it back. And congratulations, you just had a baby girl, so everything worked out great.
Yeah.
And congratulations on the film. It's really wonderful. Thank you so much for being here. Paul Dano, everybody. Wildlife in the Select Theaters nationwide now.
Hi, everyone. It's Sarah from Late Night. I'm backstage here with Paul Dano. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
We spoke on the phone. We didn't get to this in your interview with Seth, but this movie was based on a book that you read by Richard Ford.
Yeah.
So at what point did you read the story and then decide that you wanted to make it a film?
Well, I read the book randomly, you know, out of the bookstore, and just fell in love immediately with the book. I was sort of haunted by the book and thought about it over and over, reread the book. Started having images, started asking myself, why would I make a film? How can I make a film? And one of the things in the book that maybe wouldn't translate was the ending. And so I had not written before, I had not directed before, and I felt, okay, before I reach out to this writer I admire, let me feel like I know it's a film. So I really put quite a bit of work into it without having the option and knowing I was going to do it. And when I thought of the ending scene, and particularly the final image, suddenly I knew sort of why I was making the film, and it sent this ripple effect backwards throughout the story for me. And I was like, okay, that's it. I think I can do it.
So you kind of went from the end to the beginning.
I did, but because it's from a book, there is something there in place. You know, it's sort of more like the first piece of me that came out, you know, meaning it wasn't from the book, and it felt clear who I was suddenly right. in the story.
We talked about this too, that there was this amazingly beautiful scene when Carrie drives out yeah. and they see the forest fire. And I had asked you how you did that. Yeah. Can you explain sort of what
happened?
Sure,
yeah. So this is something that it's a pivotal scene in some ways. And it's one of these things as a filmmaker, you dream of how you're going to do it. It's a great sequence. And the mother takes the boy to go see this fire. I can't tell you how many times we talked about how we were going to do a real fire. It felt like something as a filmmaker that, you know, you just insist on, that there's no way you can fake this, you know, and the power of it and the feeling of it. And you say that for months and months and months, and then 2 weeks before you start filming, suddenly you can't do a real fire for many reasons. One of them being the wind and the potential danger. And we were going to try to do a controlled burn on a private property. But that private property was not where we could do the rest of the scene. So then you're splitting up your location and suddenly moving just for one shot and blah, blah, blah. So suddenly you're going, F, you know, I have to come up with a new way to do this. We're not on TV, so I probably could have sworn. And luckily we had a great company come on board called Digital District. We had that sequence pretty well choreographed and knew that we were only going to reveal this thing in sort of one shot. Mm-hmm. So we thought, if we work really hard on this one shot, we can do it. And I think we did.
I think also one of the impressive things to me about that was the sound. It really did feel like it was, you were standing there and it was coming. It was in an overwhelming way.
That's good. And first of all, that helps the VFX, you know. But we're also kind of setting that up in a couple shots before where you know what the boy is looking at, but you haven't seen it yet. So you're really in his face and in his ears, and you're listening to it without seeing it. So it kind of helps to bring you there.
Right. And then you also mentioned sort of the changing of locations and how that could have been detrimental in terms of shooting. You had a couple of moments where you had to think on your feet.
Sure. I mean, it was crazy to make a period film on a budget, and especially two locations where there's no direct flight, Montana and Oklahoma. So right. it's not easy to pop over to Oklahoma and check on something, or back to Montana and check on something. And, you know, one of the big issues we have is with period vehicles. We chose the Brinson family car based on the fact that we could get two of them because our kid can only be on camera 5.5 hours a day, which is not a lot of time. And a car rig to rig might take 45 minutes. And if we had a second one, we could be rigging while we're shooting and really cut that time down. It is, in theory, a great idea. But these cars showed up. Top choice cars, by the way, don't come in two. So we were kind of already, you're kind of looking down the list going, okay, what can we find two of? You know, it's worth it to save the time. Finally, we choose one. They show up a day, I think, before our first day of filming, maybe 2 days, but a day. One of them, the windshield is completely cracked out. I mean, huge cracks throughout the windshield. There's no way you can point a camera at it. They cannot be driving with the windshield like this. Nobody could. And how do we fix a period windshield in a day? And there was other problems in the other car. And so suddenly, instead of having the help, having time on our side, we were suddenly up against it, and we had to adjust our game plan and how we were going to shoot it. And it did create problems, and you just somehow overcome them. Another good one is we had a period bus for a scene for the kids to ride, and it showed up on the day we're meant to shoot the scene. And it was literally on the inside of this bus, a giant ball of tetanus. There was really not many seats in it left, and it was just like shards of metal. I don't know what they were thinking, saying you could use this. We probably still had to pay them. I'm assuming, maybe, I don't know if we paid them in advance, whoever we got this bus from. It was completely unusable. And suddenly you're going, F. I'm going to stick with the Fs because, you know.
Consistency.
And you have to improvise. So suddenly you're moving a scene up, or you're creating, like, what can we do in another scene now that we didn't think we were going to do today? Tell costumes we need. We're going to bump this scene up from tomorrow to today and call the local school. And we were only in this location for a day. We had to find a bus for that day. We finally found a modern bus. Luckily, on the inside, you can't even tell. But it requires you to adjust how you're going to shoot the scene.
Yeah.
Because suddenly you can't see all of the bus. And suddenly you don't have time now to do the setups you thought you were going to do.
Well, it all worked out because it's a beautiful film.
Thanks.
And thank you so much for being here.
All right. Thanks.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.